This is AgriPulse Open Mic. I'm your host, Jeff Nally. Our guest this week is Steve Nicholson, Global Strategist for Grains and Oilseeds for Rabobank. AgriPulse Open Mic is brought to you by the American Sugar Alliance. America's sweetest industry creates jobs and provides a sustainably produced food ingredient. Learn more at sugaralliance.org. AgriPulse Open Mic continues with Rabobank Steve Nicholson next. America's 11,000 sugar beet and sugarcane farmers count on a strong U.S. sugar policy to keep American consumers supplied with an essential ingredient. Better yet, it's designed to cost taxpayers nothing. These farmers support more than 151,000 jobs throughout the sugar supply chain in both urban and rural communities. They contribute over $23 billion to the economy each year and help keep it sweet in America. Learn how the Farm Bill supports sugar crop farmers and workers at sugaralliance.org. This is AgriPulse Open Mic. Despite a reduction in inflation, positive growth in the nation's GDP, job growth, and consumer spending, there are still underlying market fundamentals preventing the Fed from lowering interest rates. Steve Nicholson, Global Sector Strategist for Grains and Oilseeds with Rabobank, says Fed governors are in a darned if you do and darned if you don't situation.
The Fed has come up to that, you know, that cliff of wanting to reduce interest rates, whether it's only a mere 25 points. And every time they get to that cliff or that line, if you have it ready to step over, they get another piece of the puzzle, whether it's inflation, whether it's job creation, or wage growth. And they have to step back because they haven't seen the signals to say that they've really, and I think what it really boils down to is slaying inflation. And for those of us old enough, remember, you know, the 70s and 80s, and remember how hard it was and how high interest rates went to try to slay inflation. You know, that was a really tough, difficult economic time. And I think the Fed's also trying, you know, this is a really delicate dance to, you know, ease inflation but not send the economy into a tailspin. So they just haven't seen the right signals yet in their mind that they should be pulling inflation back. But I think it's worth saying one thing, and I want to say this sort of parenthetically, is that, you know, and I'm not discounting anyone's economic pain, so I want to say that up front. But when you look at where we are today, and let's say it's 3 to 4% inflation, and that's a little higher than what we've seen typically. You know, interest rates at 5, 5.5, where the Fed is a fairly common if you look back over history. And so I wanted to posit with people that, you know, the time period between when the Berlin Wall fell and really kind of the current time, you know, 2022 type time period, that 30 years is kind of abnormal. You know, low interest rates, low inflation. We lifted people we were basically a time of peace and prosperity. A lot of people around the world were lifted out of poverty and out of hunger. And that was a very unusual time. And the time we're in now is more normal. And I put that in quotes. And it takes us as, you know, markets are this way as well as our humans. It takes us a while to adjust our behaviors, get our brain wrapped around a new paradigm or a new situation that now becomes more of a normal situation.
I feel like the Fed is being extremely cautious here to make sure that they don't repeat history.
Absolutely correct. I think that's the other piece, that they're being very careful because they know they got off to a slow start in attacking inflation, this inflation uprim, but they also want to make sure they don't pull, in a sense, the punch, you know, they don't want to put the punch bowl back too soon because they don't want to get another, you know, another leg up, if you have it, in inflation, then have to come back and, you know, beat it back again. So it's nice if you can get it done in one shot and move forward from there.
I recall more than a year ago, the Fed was using the phrase higher for longer. And I don't think that's a phrase that the market wanted to hear, but I think the market is hearing that even now. So can higher for longer lead to a soft landing, or is higher for longer stressing certain individuals in the U.S. or certain sectors of the economy beyond what is sustainable?
I'm going to say this. I don't think it's overall stressing the economy too much at this point. I mean, look at the growth in the economy despite having 5%+ interest rates. You know, the economy is still humming along pretty well. And if you look around the globe, you know, we're kind of the outlier. The U.S. economy is sort of the outlier there. But having said that, you know, there's no question that, you know, industries that rely on lots of debt financing, that require, you know, or people who have lots of debt, whether it's adjustable mortgages or whether it's credit card, you know, are going to be, you know, overly emphasized, or they're going to, that was the right word I want to use. They're going to be, impacted by this more than others. So if you have a lot of credit card debt, or you have an adjustable rate mortgage, or you are a capital intensive industry like agriculture, you know, like you think about the real estate industry, you think about, you know, capital goods industries like airlines, which have to, you know, have a lot of capital expenses. You know, those industries are going to be, you know, more challenged by higher interest rates for a longer period of time. And so they'll adjust their spending or adjust their debt loads or adjust their, expenditures or their investments for the reality of higher interest rates for a longer period of time.
So while the Fed is holding the line here for a period of time, are we seeing some other countries caving in to pressure from consumers to lift sooner to give them a break? And does that make the U.S. vulnerable? Or what are the global, how is the global paradigm shifting as the Fed is holding this line with the dollar and with our economy?
Yeah, yes, I think there is some consumer pushback like you talk about in your question. But I also think that, you know, those economies around the world are weaker. There are some who think the European Union's already been through a recession and they don't know it yet. And so it's the economies that are not performing. And so those central banks are thinking, I've got to do something to improve the, you know, improve my economy's performance so we can, you know, move on. And so the first thing that they could do, of course, is lower that interest rate. The other thing that we have to think about from a U.S. perspective, and but also has global consequences, is the strength of the dollar. You know, as long as our interest rates stay above what we see around the globe, that is going to entice people to own dollars because it has a better return than if you buy the yen or something like that. And we've seen countries who have very, very cheap a currency, which is devaluated significantly against the dollar, and then that creates all sorts of other externalities that, you know, make U.S. goods harder to export because they're more expensive. Or vice versa, it makes imports cheaper, and so, you know, other countries then get to export more because they have cheaper currencies versus the dollar, and it goes hand in hand. But then you have the issues of debt, you know, the higher debt, and then you have people who have debt, and it's evaluated in U.S. dollars, and with an expensive dollar, that makes it that they have more to pay back, and so it cripples countries to a certain point of what their options are when it comes to managing their economy. So I think it's as much about the economy as it about consumers' concerns, but there's certainly consumers are concerned about lots of things around the globe, and we've seen that in some of the, you know, political outcomes of the last several weeks.
Steve, Washington is overdue now to write new farm policy. And while we are dealing with increased competition and we are dealing with sketchy demand from traditional customers, while we're dealing with uncertainty over weather and the climate that we are operating in, a question over input supplies, there's plenty of question around the agriculture industry. But with regard to the economy, how is this a wild card for writing new farm policy? And what would you suggest is important for lawmakers to keep in mind as they craft a bill for the next 5 years?
Let's talk about the farm bill and what it does and what's important about it. And I think this is what lawmakers have to remember. Like agriculture, you know, agriculture evolves. There's rarely a revolution in agriculture. And farm policy is the same way. It evolves. And I think it's important for lawmakers to understand that as you write a farm bill, you have to make, if you make changes, you have to make them in increments. Because the industry it's difficult for the industry to adapt quickly to a big change. you know, if you looked over time, over, you know, my lifetime, you've seen the whole safety net for producers change. But it's evolved over time. You've seen maybe people might say a couple of revolutions, you look freedom to farm or something like that. But the safety net was still there. It just changed some of the rules, how you could qualify the safety net or what you could do to be participant in that safety net. And so I think it's important for lawmakers to understand that you can't make big changes, and you need to get that in place sooner than later, because people make decisions based on what the law is. And if they make a decision on what the law is today and lawmakers change it, then that has economic consequences on the farm that I don't think people realize how much they can be. And you think now today, well, the safety net is certainly different than it was when you and I grew up. But the fact is, the big safety net today is crop insurance. And so we need to know what that is for crop insurance. What kind of expense will that be? Will there be a change in the premium structure? Will there be a change in how we determine prices that are used for it? Will it be determined by other different, you know, new additions to crop insurance? You know, those are really important questions for producers that may impact both, you know, decisions about marketing, decisions about what crops or animals they produce and how they behave. And so we need to have that in place now so that producers can make that decision. You know, this season is gone. I mean, those decisions have been made for this current season. But, you know, as we get, you know, it's here mid-June, you know, we're a short 4 months from now. You know, producers will start to be making decisions for 25. So we need to have that in place sooner rather than later.
We have the opportunity, you and I, to stand outside the outfield and spitball things for just a minute. And I take nothing away from ARC and PLC. I take nothing away from Title I. But
right.
The reality is that that's based on an economic time that has gone long ago for U.S. agriculture. And I think if we had a room full of producers here, they would share that the ultimate in risk management has come down to crop insurance and their ability to draw from the marketplace. Is it better for Washington to try to invest in reference prices? Is it better to try to build the floor under the marketplace with policy? Or is it better to expand the crop insurance opportunities and give them some flexibility to manage their risk in their own fashion?
So, you know, my bias is that let's let crop insurance do that and give them more options so that, you know, we can encourage, and we do need other crops other than corn, soybeans, and wheat, for example. You know, make sure we can encourage it and give them certainty that if something does go wrong, whether it's a drought, whether it's, you know, whatever the case, you know, revenue insurance, you know, if the markets get pummeled for whatever reason, that there's a floor, and crop insurance is that place where you can use a floor. And at the same time, that way everybody has skin in the game. The producer has skin in the game. The government has skin in the game. The taxpayer has skin in the game. And so that, to me, is a better option, if you put it in that sense of a kind of a bifurcated decision, is probably a better option than ARC and PLC or reference prices or target prices. You know, all those sorts of things. You know, how can we make sure that there's a backstop for the producer? Because the producer has, you know, other risks that are really out of his or her hands. You know, the weather certainly they have no influence over the weather. They don't have influence over geopolitical events that might happen, you know, far, far away. You know, or changes in markets that, you know, or consumers' trend, you know, consumers' changes over time, although that can come and go pretty quickly, or it happens over a long period of time. But if we give, you know, insurance, if you have an underlying support, then the farmer or the producer can make that decision how they're going to do based on what that underlying support is, rather than to say, well, I know the reference price for corn is X versus soybeans, and I look at my situation, well, I'll go for that, you know, for that because that's gives me the most money, versus let's make sure what's the market want and produce for the marketplace, as we always say.
Given the economy that we have now and giving the increased production from the Black Sea, certainly from Argentina and Brazil, and then that of the U.S., are we more likely to see prices move back above these levels that we're standing now? Or is there a new paradigm coming with price levels that are much lower than what producers would call profitable now?
Yeah, I'm fearful and concerned. Maybe concern's a better word than fearful. I am concerned that we're entering a time period of overproduction in the sense that we're building stocks in the world. You know, you look at, even though we're likely to lose upwards of 20 million metric tons of wheat production out of Europe and Russia this year, I'm concerned we're coming into a time period of overstocks or building of stocks, as, you know, genetics get better with crops, they deal with changes in the weather easier. We've been through a time period, in particularly in North America, of pretty dry weather, and it appears like that, you know, starting to turn around a little bit. And so we're going to have to get to a situation where there's going to have to be some adjustments made on the input cost side, whether that's by the producer, who will make those adjustments in their purchases, or by input suppliers and costs and prices. And also the biggest one, of course, there is land costs. You know, what do land costs do? And with, you know, with higher interest rates. Now, this is a discussion of degrees. You know, it's not like interest rates are 18% like we remember back in the 1980s. You know, so I don't think their impact on land prices will be as certainly as dramatic as it was in the 1980s at this point. But the fact is, you do have now makes when you make investments, you're going to make them a little more cautiously because there's a cost associated with them. So we do need to see input costs come down because commodity prices have certainly come off the highs that we saw back in 22, you know, 21 and 22.
Steve, not entering you into a political position, but it does seem that this administration is dealing with tariffs and less with trade agreements. And yes, the previous president and the candidate now is threatening to deal with the world with greater tariffs. The base question is, what's the danger or what's the effectiveness of dealing with world trade balances with tariffs rather than agreements?
So, you know, my bias up front is I don't like tariffs. I'd rather have free trade. I'd rather have more free trade or trade agreements so we all get to abide by the same rules. But when you bring tariffs into the equation, you create islands of haves and have-nots, and you increase cost to the consumer. And so that creates issues that we've seen before. You know, you think about, you know, we had tariffs back in the 1910s and 1920s, what we obviously call it was the Roaring Twenties, and then you saw the Smoot-Hawley Bill come in that, you know, precluded, you know, the Great Depression because the economies fell apart and could not stand the increase of cost due to, you know, the high tariffs. Now, it does insulate economies. It insulates workers. It insulates industries from competition. But in the long run, you know, that does not work long term. It's a little discouraging to me that all of the discussions have turned around trade have come back to tariffs rather than to sit down and really think about what is it, you know, how is it that we grow the economy or grow the pie versus shrink the pie? And having said all that, I recognize that there have been folks who were hurt by free trade because they lost jobs because industries moved to different places of lower labor. And I think the danger or the challenge for us if we go down, you know, a tariff route is that short term, it may look better for you, but longer term, it likely doesn't. But in a free trade environment, you know, it does have the same long-term effects as that people will be losing positions or, you know, jobs will be moved because that's what makes economies go. But at the same time, if we go down this route either way, we're not doing anything to make sure that whether it's you or me or whether it's that person who works on the line in Detroit or wherever on what line that is or what job they have, is that there is an opportunity for them to find another occupation or to find training or to help them transition to something new. And I think that's what gets lost in a lot of these trade discussions is how do we move the economy to whatever that new economy looks like? And, you know, we have plenty of history, whether it's the last 40 or 50 years or whether it's the last nearly 100 years, to look at and see how these things work. And we can now make better decisions than we did back in 1900 or 1910 or 1920 or 1929. And in even the most recent history of the free trade agreements that we see. But I do worry about that. And when you think about when you isolate industries, you know, during the tariffs, those industries tend to shrink rather than to grow. And, you know, there are plenty of examples of that in history, that's happening.
Steve, what are the news headlines or what are the bellwethers in the market that will give us a clearer indication of what to expect from the Fed here in 24 and ahead in 25?
Yeah, great question. I think the first one we have to think about is the election itself, and not to get too political. You know, the Fed does not want to get involved as being accused of putting their thumb on the scale for one candidate or other. And so I think there's, as we get closer and closer to November, the Fed's going to be more and more reluctant, I think, to intervene with the economy. So I think that's the one thing just to keep in mind. The other thing that the Fed will be watching very closely, as they always do, is what does the personal consumption expenditure do? Do they see it back to 2%? Now, there's a lot of discussion that maybe 2% is not the right number. Maybe that number needs to be 2.5% inflation versus 2%. And will economists continue to argue over this? And I expect that will. But I think if we see a sub-3 on that personal consumption expenditure, that will be a signal that the Fed may be very much more willing to maybe ease up a little bit on the interest rates. But the other piece, of course, is their other mandate, of course, is employment. And so the good news is employment's continued to grow and job growth has continued to happen. And so they'll look to see, is that slowing down? And if it is slowing down on a consistent basis, you know, we've had months, I may get this wrong. So we've had the month of June where we had, or month of May, we had 270,000 job creation. And you're like, wow. And like the month before was like 150 and you think, boy, here it comes. But, you know, you get this rebound in April. And so the Fed's like kind of has to stand up and take note and go, well, this economy hasn't cooled down enough for us to feel like we could take the foot off interest rates. But as I said before, why would you take your foot off the interest rates when the economy is still performing well? You're still creating jobs. Yes, inflation is a little bit higher than you'd like, but you're still creating jobs. You're still seeing GDP growth. And so it's at 5 or 5.5%. So it's a very delicate balance those are the three things I would be watching. And I'm watching very carefully to see, you know, what happens. The employment and the labor situation is an extremely important bellwether for both the Fed and the economy's health.
Well, Steve Nicholson, we want to thank you for your insight into the marketplace and for taking time to be with us on this edition of Open Mic. Steve, this is Open Mic, and today you have an open microphone for your thoughts.
Well, Jeff, as always, it's great to talk to you, and thanks for having me. I think this is a fascinating time, and economists, you know, to see changes in the economy like we're having today is always fascinating. I always learn something. I always come back and go, boy, why didn't I look at it that way when the economy taught me something different? So it's, you know, my thing, I talk to young economists and I talk to consumers and I talk to folks in the world, you know, be curious, always be open and be paying attention because there's something going to happen. You're going to learn and you're going to be a better consumer, a better person, and a better person overall in society.
Our thanks to Steve Nicholson, global strategist for grains and oilseeds for Rabobank, our guest this week on Open Mic. AgriPulse Open Mic is brought to you by the American Sugar Alliance. America's sweetest industry creates jobs and provides a sustainably produced food ingredient. Learn more at sugaralliance.org. For AgriPulse, I'm Jeff Nally.